This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The Pulitzer Prize for Poetry was awarded yesterday to W.S. Merwin for his book, The Shadow of Sirius. That's S-I-R-I-U-S. The citation describes it as a collection of luminous, often tender poems that focus on the profound power of memory. This is Merwin's second Pulitzer. When he first won in 1971, he was best known for his poems against the war in Vietnam. A couple of years ago, in an L.A. Times review of his collection, The Book of Fables, Amy Gerstler described Merwin as, quote, a post-Presbyterian Zen poet and channeler of ancient paradoxes. He strikes a balance between the world we know with our senses and those occult regions we are only intermittently privy to, unquote. Merwin was born in 1927, the son of a Presbyterian minister. He now lives in Hawaii, where he's active in environmental issues. I spoke with him last December after The Shadow of Sirius was published. We started with a reading of his poem, A Likeness.
Almost to your birthday, and as I am getting dressed, alone in the house, a button comes off, and once I find a needle with an eye big enough for me to try to thread it, and at last have sewed the button on. I open an old picture of you who always did such things by magic. One photograph found after you died of you at 20, beautiful in a way I would never see, for that was 9 years before I was born. But the picture has faded suddenly, spots have marred it, maybe it is past repair. I have only what I remember.
I love that last line, I have only what I remember, that you have this photograph of your mother. I assume it's your mother.
Yes.
And the photograph is marred and you only have what you remember. You know, memory is always such an issue for me. You know, do you struggle to chronicle your life, to keep the photographs, to document it, to keep journals, to hold on to all the memories, or do you accept that you have only what you remember?
I think we do both. I think we always do both. And what we think of as the present really is the past. It is made out of the past. The present is an absolutely transparent moment that only great saints ever see occasionally. But the present that we think of as the present is made up of the past. And the past is always one moment. It's what happened 3 minutes ago, and 1 minute is what happened 30 years ago. And they flow into each other in ways that we can't predict and that we keep discovering in dreams, which keep bringing up feelings and moments, some of which we never actually saw. But those moments themselves bring up the feelings that we had forgotten we had. And it's all memory. I think the idea that memory is somehow sentimental or nostalgic. Nostalgia itself is the etymology of nostalgia is homecoming. And homecoming is what we all believe in. I mean, if we didn't believe in homecoming, we wouldn't be able to bear the day.
As you get older, do you spend more time thinking about your early memories, your childhood, your formative years?
I do. I think this is one of the benefits of getting older, that one has that perspective on things farther away. One is so caught up in middle years in the idea of accomplishing something, when in fact the full accomplishment is always with one.
Several of the poems in your book are about your parents. This is one of them. It's called A Single Autumn. Would you introduce it for us and read it?
Yes, this is something I think I'd thought about quite often. And why my parents died very close together. I thought they weren't very close together. But actually, one of their great gifts to me was that neither of them turned out to be afraid of dying at all. And in quite different ways, they died without any expression of anxiety or of dread or of clutching at anything else. And that's a great gift to be given, that feeling of no fear. And I think I inherited it from them very early. But after my mother died, I was away in Europe when she died. And when I came back, the first funeral was already over. And I moved right into the house against the advice of many friends, and spent something like a month or 6 weeks there. And giving away their belongings to their friends and getting to know their friends, and then finally giving away the furniture things to my sister, and being there in a totally empty house before I just left it and went back to New York. This is about that time of being alone in that empty house. When, if it hit me hard, I was all by myself and it didn't matter. And if it didn't, I went through all of the feelings and no feelings that one has at that time, noticing that, that there were many things that we would never, bits of conversation that we would never finish. And so this is a poem about that called A Single Autumn. The year my parents died, one that summer, one that fall, 3 months and 3 days apart. I moved into the house where they had lived their last years. It had never been theirs, and was still theirs in that way for a while. Echoes in every room without a sound. All the things that we had never been able to say, I could not remember. Doll collection in a china cabinet, plates stacked on shelves, lace on drop-leaf tables, a dried branch of bittersweet before a hall mirror, we're all planning to wait. The glass door of the house remained closed. The days had turned cold, and out in the tall hickories, the blaze of autumn had begun on its own. I could do anything.
God, I love that last line. I could do anything. And I think, what were some of the things that you wouldn't have done when your parents were alive living in that house?
Well, all the inhibitions one has with parents. And my father was when he was younger, a very repressive, capricious, punitive, incomprehensible, distant person. And I've freed myself from that insofar as one ever frees oneself from any such influence fairly early. But one was always aware of the things that would trouble either of them. And all of those things were gone. I mean, I could say or do or think or go or meet or talk to anything, anybody the way I wanted to. I was as free there as I was anywhere in the world. And it was a sort of desolate freedom, of course.
When you were going through your parents' possessions and figuring out what to give away, what to keep, what to throw away, what did you decide to keep?
Not very much. My father was a minister, and he asked me to burn all his sermons. They were terrible sermons.
Well, what made them terrible? Why do you describe them as terrible?
Oh, he never finished a sentence, and they were...
Well, you never even have periods in your poems. That's really funny.
Yeah. No, but these were all dashes like Emily Dickinson. Uh-huh. They were very unoriginal. Mm-hmm. And he just obviously didn't want them kept.
Did you want to keep them for yourself, or did you obey the wishes?
I did want to keep some, and I wanted to keep various correspondences that my mother had there that were marked "burn this," so I burned them. And sometimes I feel like that Eric Broad, the way Eric Broad must have felt very pleased that he kept Kafka's papers, or in spite of Kafka's wishes. I sometimes wish that I'd read through them and kept the ones I wanted to, but I didn't. It's at that moment you're very eager to do what they wanted you to. But I kept strange things. I kept things that my mother was growing in the garden. I potted them up and took them back to the apartment and grew them in New York. One or two last bits of clothing that were hanging in a closet. Very little, They weren't people who had much money. And there was nothing of great value there. And, oh, odds and ends, a few small things from my grandfather. I mean, a penknife from my grandfather, little tiny things like that that would have meant nothing to anybody else. And all the other thing that I kept from the house, I gave my sister all the furniture. That we divided everything up quite equitably. And I kept all of the papers. So there were diaries and day books and account books and all sorts of stuff that I used later.
When you say used, you mean used in poems?
Yes, used in poems and used in writing unframed originals. And she was an orphan. It was her father had worked for the Pennsylvania Railroad, and he had passes for all of the railroads that existed in the very beginning of the 20th century and that had ceased to exist. It was wonderful taking out his book of passes and seeing all of the non-existent railroads that he could ride free on.
Oh, that sounds wonderful. So you still have that?
I still have them, yes.
Your father was a minister. What were you taught about God? What did you believe about God when you were young?
Oh, I had to learn the catechism. And but it was mostly proscriptive the things you couldn't do. There was no card playing in the house and no dancing and not much of anything that was fun. That gradually all shelled off. He got better about it as I got older. And then he became a chaplain in the Second World War and went overseas. And so in my early adolescence, I was freed of all of that. And managed to sort of get along with him much better in later years. But he was pretty remote. He didn't know how to be a father.
Did he know that you became a poet? And what did he think poetry was frivolous?
No, he didn't. He thought it was fine. And when I felt that I was, in effect, a pacifist at the end of World War II, and I was put in the psycho ward in the Chelsea Naval Hospital.
You were? You were?
I was, yeah.
Were put in the mental ward for being a pacifist?
Yeah, because I had enlisted, you see, when I was 17, and all of this cogitation about it had come later. And I finally asked to be put in the brig because I said I'd made a terrible mistake and I should never have enlisted. I don't really believe in what we're doing. And I was instead put in the psycho ward. And I was pretty lucky, I guess. But he came to the Chelsea Hospital and talked to the chaplain there and came to see me as a visitor and said, you must follow your own convictions. And I thought, that's pretty good, you know. He's never said that before.
What year was this that you were put in the psycho ward?
Oh, when was it? 46, I guess.
Uh-huh. So what was your treatment?
Oh, they tried to scare me, I guess. But it was basically rather humane. I was locked up. I was in a big ward, and there were some people who had real trouble. I mean, hallucinations and DTs from alcoholism and brain damage from active duty and all mixed in together. I made some good friends there in the ward whom I never saw again.
Did being locked up in a psychiatric ward make you question your own sanity? Were you able to be confident the whole time that you were locked up under false pretenses and you were perfectly sane, you were just dissenting?
Oh, I realized that it was because of dissenting. But I didn't question, the more I thought about, I thought, I can't allow myself to be trained to kill on orders, to take life on orders. I mean, I really took the idea of not killing seriously. And I thought, whatever I'm told, killing is still my responsibility if I do it. I can't say it's because I was ordered to, because I know I don't really believe that. I don't believe I would kill on orders. I don't believe I would take life because somebody told me to. And these are people who are doing it for reasons of their own and for reasons, some of which I don't know. And the people I'm supposed to kill are people whom I don't know. I can imagine circumstances in which I might do it. I can imagine being in the resistance or something like that where I would do it. But it would be extreme circumstances in which I could feel that I was taking that responsibility on myself, just as we do when we kill a mosquito or an ant. I don't think we have a right to take life, any life. I think we take it knowing that we do and knowing that we have no right to do it, and we're responsible for it.
I don't know how you feel about talking about this, but how do you feel about getting older? You're in your early 80s now, and dealing with the dimming of some of the senses in a body that isn't as strong as it was. I don't know if you have a lot of pain, physical ailments associated with that, but you have to accept a certain amount of physical diminishment as you age. How are you at accepting that or dealing with it?
The one thing so far that I find a little difficult is that my having always had wonderful eyes, my eyes aren't as good as they used to be, and so I have to get used to that. But I have a great guide in this matter. I had a magnificent creature, an incredible character, a black chow, who at the age of 8 went blind, totally blind. And you had to tell people about that because she always knew everything. And she would guide me if I was out somewhere and I was taking her for a walk and forgot a flashlight and it got dark. She'd take me home. And I thought, the way she confronted absolutely everything without fear, without panic, without anything of the kind, this is one of the great guiding spirits of my life. And as my eyes get worse, I think of Muku more and more often, and that's a very pleasant thing to do, because I think, how would Muku have dealt with this situation? And you know very well how she would have done it.
We have time for one more poem, and I'd like to ask you to close with a poem called Rain Light, if you can introduce it for us first.
I shall. It's again a poem in the last section of the book, and it's about... What is it about? It's about the very thing you were talking about. I mean, what happens as you face the fact that the entire world is slipping, literally dissolving around you, around us? You know, we have that feeling about our civilization and about our species and everything else is all endangered, and indeed it is. And we either face that as a recognition as that's our moment, Or we sort of groan and dread it, which is a waste of time. But this is not a rational poem at all. It's called Rain Light. Early morning rain, which is something that I love very much. All day the stars watch from long ago. My mother said, I am going now. When you are alone, you will be all right. Whether or not you know, you will know. Look at the old house in the dawn rain. All the flowers are forms of water. The sun reminds them through a white cloud, touches the patchwork spread on the hill, the washed colors of the afterlife that lived there long before you were born. See how they wake without a question, even though the whole world is burning.
W.S. Merwin, thank you so much for talking with us and for reading some of your poems. Thank you.
Thank you, Terry.
W.S. Merwin recorded last December after the publication of his collection of poems, The Shadow of Sirius. Yesterday, that book won the Pulitzer Prize for Poetry. The Pulitzer Prize for Music went to Steve Reich for his composition Double Sextet. Here's an excerpt of the final movement performed by the ensemble Eighth Blackbird, which commissioned the piece. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. A concept album about fuel-efficient cars may not sound like the most promising idea for lively music, but it's what Neil Young has done with his new collection of songs called Fork in the Road. Rock critic Ken Tucker says the concept worked.
Neil Young begins Fork in the Road singing about how he's touring the country playing music and driving, or playing driving music in every sense. The bulk of Fork in the Road was written in late 2008, during and between concert tour dates. The music has that deceptively dashed-off quality that's characteristic of younger-than-Neil hip-hop performers, punk-inspired rockers, and the rare musicians of Neil Young's generation who haven't settled into complacent craftsmanship. Directly addressing that Neil Young generation I just mentioned, Young composes a tune with the refrain, "Just singing a song won't change the world." In Young's current view from the highway, his 1959 Lincoln Continental retooled to run on alternative energy, peace and love has given way to pollution and the economy. Using blues structures and rock rhythms, Young manages to make almost poetry out of a lumpy couplet like, "The awesome power of electricity stored for you in a giant battery." What sells this stuff is the inescapable feeling that Neil Young really does think the humble battery is, well, awesome.
Johnny Magic had a way with
on a first listen, the music can sound repetitive, but pretty soon I realized that the pleasure I was getting from listening over and over lay in the fact that this is a jam album. Young and longtime collaborators such as the multi-instrumentalist Ben Keith blast out lots of noise in the manner of other underrated Neil Young albums, like 1974's On the Beach. And its politics are better articulated than they were on more recent records, like the 2006 Living with War.
Got a pot belly, it's not too big, gets in my way when I'm driving my rig, driving this country in a big old rig, things I see mean a lot.
In that title song, Young slips back and forth between the characters of a truck driver and a, quote, big rock star. As the rock star, he sings, "My sales have tanked, but I still got you, thanks." Whether talking about gas tanks or stock market tanks, Young has made a first-rate album for the new economic policy, how it affects him, you, and the citizens he sees on the road. And as he advises, never take your eyes off the road.
Ken Tucker is editor-at-large at Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed Neil Young's new CD, Fork in the Road. The writer J.G. Ballard died of cancer Sunday at the age of 78. In his New York Times obituary, Bruce Weber described Ballard as having an imagination attracted to catastrophic events and a melancholy view of the human soul as being corrupted by the modern world. Ballard was often described as a science fiction writer. He described science fiction as stories about the here and now, because we are living inside an enormous science fiction novel. Ballard's 1973 novel Crash, about a deviant subculture that has fetishized car crashes, was adapted into a film by David Cronenberg. Ballard's semi-autobiographical novel Empire of the Sun was adapted into a film by Steven Spielberg. It was based on Ballard's experience coming of age in a prisoner of war camp during World War II. Ballard was born in Shanghai, where his father managed a British firm. In 1943, his family and other foreigners were detained by the Japanese. Japan had invaded China 6 years earlier. I spoke with Ballard in 1988.
You had very extraordinary experiences as a child. You were living in Shanghai and with your parents in a British community, and became a prisoner of war in a Japanese camp during World War II. I was surprised to find out that, unlike your book and the movie based on your book, you were imprisoned with your parents. In your book, you're separated and you're imprisoned alone.
Yes. I mean, I've never made any secret of that. I mean, Empire of the Sun is a novel.
Right.
It's semi-autobiographical. It's partly based on my own first-hand experiences. And part of it, being a novel, is invented. But there are many points of contact. I mean, I'm the same age as the boy, Jim. I was born in Shanghai like him. I lived in that house, went to that school, had those parents. I was in Shanghai when the Japanese invaded China. I was there in Shanghai when, the morning after Pearl Harbor, they seized Shanghai. And I was interned in the same camp. But, and it's a big difference, my parents were with me. Though, I'd say that, I mean, people have said to me, we know it's a novel, but why did you leave your parents out? And I think the reason is that it was psychologically truer to my own experiences to present my alter ego, as it were, the boy Jim in the book, to present him alone, because I think I was alone. I think a sort of estrangement took place between myself and my parents during the camp years, and the book is truer to the psychology of my own life.
Well, you know, you get the impression of a child who was, you know, fairly repressed, you know, and coming up in a prosperous family, suddenly having to survive on his wits in this camp and becoming very, very resourceful, learning how to steal and trade to get extra food, to get books, to get other items that would be of interest or of value. Did you go through that yourself?
Yes, I did. I mean, a lot of the boys' experiences in Empire of the Sun are taken straight from my own life. I used to run errands for the American merchant seamen who were in the camp and who had a hoard of Reader's Digests, which were, you know, I'd do anything to get hold of those.
What's an example of one of the things you did to get hold of them?
Well, I run general errands for them. I mean, things like crawling through the wire and setting up these pheasant traps, collecting bits of wood for the little fires that people would light, and general dogs bodying around the place. I mean, I wasn't constantly scavenging. I don't want to give that impression, but you've got to, I mean, this was a big camp, 2,000 people. The size of a small town, and it was really a huge slum. And as in all slums, it's the teenage boys who run wild. And, I ran wild.
It must be really something to come of age, to undergo puberty Well, while living in a prisoner of war camp.
Yes, I mean, I won't say that anything wonderful and mysterious happened to me. The, you know, one ran around with a pack of pretty wild girls at the same time. But yes, it was. I mean, it was a huge nuclear family. I mean, this was the bizarre thing. There were about 300 children, and we all ran wild together. I mean, it's a strange thing to say, but in many ways, I had quite a good time there.
Well, it's certainly the impression you get from the book and the movie, that there were a lot of things that you were, a lot of freedom that you had in your own way, because anything went, even though you were prisoners.
Well, we were out of control of our parents. This is the big thing. I mean, in an ordinary family, the parents have a certain amount of leverage on their kids. They, you know, there are pocket money, there are treats, little bits of candy or presents. You know, the parents can say, well, what do you want for Christmas? And this helps to maintain their authority over their children. Now, in our camp, there were no treats. There was no candy. There were no Christmas presents. The food ration, such as it was, you know, delivered once a day. And, you know, the parents did nothing to provide for their children in that sense, though of course many parents starve themselves to feed their children. I don't want to give the impression that the children were totally on their own. They weren't, but there weren't those levers to pull. So particularly the teenage boys like myself did run wild and got up to amazing pranks when I look back.
I want to ask you one more thing about the younger part of your life. When you got out of the prisoner of war camp, in which you explained your parents basically had no control over you and you ran wild with the rest of the kids and the teenagers, when you went back to England and you started going to school in England, was it possible for any of the adults to discipline you after that? Did you have any, you know, respect for authority figures like parents and teachers afterwards?
Not much, no. No, to be honest, Well, I came to England, you see, for the first time in 1946 at the age of nearly 16 and went to a British boarding school, which was rather like a camp, rather like a prison camp in many ways. I mean, rather like the camp I'd been in, only, you know, to be honest, the food was even worse. And I found it weird and very, very strange. I found England very strange. I wasn't prepared for it. I mean, I'd come from a very hot landscape of rice paddies and monsoons and summer floods. And I arrived at this dark, grey, northern country with a light. I mean, it seemed to be sort of, it always seemed to be early evening and it always seemed to be raining. And everybody seemed, I mean, England was exhausted by the war. The country was, you know, physically half destroyed by the German bombing, and I felt a stranger there, and still do in many respects. It was a very dark, closed, sort of, you know, repressed kind of world, and going to school there and then to university was all very mysterious. The English class system was so complicated, I couldn't understand it. Still don't in many ways. So it was a difficult time, but, I mean, I wasn't unhappy, but it was like sort of, you know, a young American going to live in Japan, let's say, in the 1930s. You know, you're an outsider. There's no hope of understanding the complicated social relationships and all the little rituals and all the rest of it. It takes years to...
But you stayed. It's not like you moved someplace else.
Well, you see, in 1949, my father stayed on in Shanghai after the war. But in 1949, the communists took over the whole of China. And in fact, my father was caught by the communists in Shanghai. And he was there for about a year until he was finally able to get out. And I knew by 1949 that I would never go back to China, that I had to make my home in England. Mm-hmm. Then I got married and had children. And I always dreamed of going abroad. Still do. But, you know, inertia takes over. And I am English. I mean, I can't pretend that I'm not.
There's a book of yours that I really must ask you about. This is a novel that you wrote, I think it was 1973, called Crash. And the book kind of was about someone who was almost erotically obsessed with car crashes and with the wounds inflicted by car crashes. And this character has fantasies of blood and mucus and sperm mingling on the dashboard of a car after a crash. It's a very upsetting book. I would love to know what was on your mind when you wrote this.
Something pretty nasty, I think, if I look back. But it was a serious novel. I mean, it wasn't just a sensational horror story. I mean, I was very conscious in the 70s of the way in which the, you know, what I call the media landscape, of particularly, you know, TV and mass advertising, was beginning to, you know, create the world that we inhabited. And it seemed to me that the sort of this TV landscape we all live in, or the media landscape we all live in, is hungry for sensation. And we saw then the way in which violence was beginning to be, beginning to take the sort of place that sex had occupied up until, say, the 60s. Then attitudes towards sex liberalized. And people needed a new thrill. And one began to see, I mean, movies got a lot more violent. Television itself began to show endless scenes of Civil War newsreels from the Congo and Bangladesh, and then, of course, Vietnam. Very, very graphic scenes of violence were shown, but neutralized by the TV screen. I mean, people saw incredible horrors on their living room screens while they were eating their suppers. But they weren't touched by the violence. And it seemed to me that I wanted to look at the way that sort of violence was beginning to enter into people's imaginations. And Crash took an extreme example of this, because car crashes, of course, in movies and so on, play a key role. So I try to be honest about it and let my own imagination rip.
Well, I think I read that after you wrote Crash, that you were in a car crash yourself, and in fact one in which your car rolled over a couple of times. Is that right?
Yeah, that was a sort of extreme case of nature imitating art.
Well, did your book about this person who had eroticized car crashes affect the way you experienced your car crash at all? I'm not saying that you got into it or anything, but I mean, you must have thought about what it meant that you'd written this book. You'd spent all this time seeing things through the eyes of the character, and then you were in this terrible car crash yourself.
Yes, and I often thought that if I died in the car crash, people would have said, yes, Ballard was finding, you know, sort of the ultimate sex death that he'd been writing and dreaming about. Actually, by a miracle, I wasn't hurt at all, though the car rolled over on a divided carriageway and obliterated a whole lot of street lamps and sign indicators. The roof was crushed down, and I couldn't get out, actually. It was a miracle that it didn't burst into flames, because people were running around the car, rocking it and shouting, well, petrol, petrol, gasoline, gasoline. But, you know, some guardian angel kept watch over me that evening. But, I mean, when one writes a novel, one's working with metaphors, with the materials of the imagination. And the Crash is a kind of extreme metaphor to deal with an extreme possibility.
J.G. Ballard, recorded in 1988. He died of cancer Sunday at the age of 78. The British chef Gordon Ramsay has won 16 Michelin stars and owns restaurants from London to Tokyo, New York to Dubai. He's also a television icon at home and in the U.S., where he has two shows, Hell's Kitchen, currently in its fifth season on Fox, and Kitchen Nightmares, based on his hit British program Ramsay's Kitchen Nightmares. The complete first season of that original show is now out on DVD from Acorn Media. And our critic at large, John Power, says that the larger-than-life Ramsay dishes up much more than the usual reality TV star.
When I was first starting out as a writer, movie directors were superstars, and everybody wanted to be a film critic. I remember teasing my paper's restaurant critic that writing about food was the lowest adult job in journalism. Turns out I've had to eat those words. These days, movies are increasingly kid stuff, and food has become a national obsession. The new superstars are chefs. None is bigger than Gordon Ramsay, the Scottish-born cook who may not be the world's greatest chef, though his restaurants do rank third in total number of Michelin stars. But he's undeniably the world's greatest TV chef. Ramsay doesn't inhabit the backwaters of basic cable or the niche programming of the Food Network. He has two compulsively watchable primetime reality programs on Fox, both of them remakes of shows that were already hits in the UK. The more popular of the two is Hell's Kitchen. It's one of those Darwinian shows like Survivor or Project Runway that weekly renders one contestant extinct. It features a collection of wannabe star chefs who are initially put into teams. Each week, Ramsay orders them to perform various tasks, make tapas out of leftovers, or prepare breakfast for a squadron of soldiers. As the competitors beaver away alongside their backbiting compatriots, Gordon lays on his advice like a cross between Simon Cowell and Deadwood's Al Swearengen. Tim Gunn, he's not. His idea of saying make it work is you better make it bleeping work, you stupid bleepity bleep. Ramsay's other and better show is Kitchen Nightmares, which is less about competition than about running a food business. Each week, Ramsay goes to a restaurant that's on the verge of ruin and tries to help straighten things out with heavy lashings of advice and disdain and high praise when it's earned. If you've never seen this show, there's no better introduction than the original uncensored British version now available on DVD. Indeed, the very first episode is a classic. Ramsay goes to rescue a bistro called Bonaparte's in a small Yorkshire town with the unlovely name of Silsden. The place is floundering, and it doesn't take our Gordon long to see why. The owner, Sue, is clueless and uninvolved. The shishi menu is hilariously inappropriate for provincial customers. And to top it all off, the 21-year-old chef, Tim, dreams of being a star TV chef like Gordon Ramsay. But he has one huge shortcoming. He can't even cook an omelet. Here, Ramsay talks about serving appetizers and puts a challenge to Tim.
Even when the kitchen's busy, you should be looking to get the starters out within 10 minutes of receiving the order.
Thank you very much.
These poor souls have waited half an hour for their pigeon breast with mushroom ravioli. And that's not the only problem.
Tim, you made a ravioli?
Yes.
It's burnt. Do you not taste that there?
No.
Smell it then. You honestly can't taste that burnt?
But now you point it out. Yeah.
Part of what makes Kitchen Nightmares so utterly fascinating is that it's a wonderful show about process. It teaches you how restaurants work and how they don't work. Week after week, we meet owners who are scared of their staff or don't know their market, chefs who ruin expensive ingredients with absurdly gimmicky sauces, then try to save money by keeping other food till it's tainted. Watching it, you realize the sheer complexity of running a good restaurant. Just keeping the order straight seems exhausting. Which is why when Ramsay revisits these restaurants months later at the end of the episode, they've often fallen back into chaos. Of course, the show's undeniable draw is Ramsay himself, a mercurial, charismatic figure who's at once charming and hot-headed, generous and vain, sanctimonious and prone to soaring arpeggios of obscenity. Audiences love this kind of oversized guru figure. And Ramsay's like the Dr. House of sick restaurants. He invariably makes places better. But what gives his act its special tang is that he's a reminder of how much food culture has changed since the kinder, gentler days when Julia Child first began educating home cooks and Graham Kerr, the jaunty metrosexual known as the Galloping Gourmet, taught Americans to describe a wine as a sporty little traveler. Now we're in the heyday of TV's bad boy chefs, Anthony Bourdain, Mario Batali, Jamie Oliver, for whom even Emeril's BAM seems positively unmanly. None is more macho than Ramsay, a hulking one-time pro soccer player whose restaurants may be fussy, even Frenchified, but whose personal style comes heavily sauced with testosterone. Watching his shows, one sees just how much male aggression has moved from the playing fields and into the kitchen. In the world of Gordon Ramsay, cooking is an extreme sport.
John Powers is film critic for Vogue. He reviewed the first season of Ramsay's Kitchen Nightmares, which is now out on DVD. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org.